This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Aquarium Mania. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Anand, speaking to you from the University of Florida, IFAS, Tropical Aquaculture Laboratory. Thanks for joining us. Where in the world are Sunda, Wallacea, and Sahul? My guest today, Sam Fernald, a lifelong aquarist, taxonomist, and founder and co-owner of Hillstream Kingdom LLC, a specialty aquarium fish wholesaler based in Maine and Guangdong, has a great appreciation for and expertise with the fishes from these areas around Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. These include the unusual and beautiful Hillstream loaches. Join us as Sam explains the geologic and evolutionary importance of their native ranges and shares his passion and interest in bringing these beautiful new species into the aquarium hobby. We'll be right back after these messages.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Aquarium Mania on Pet Life Radio. My guest today is Sam Fernald, lifelong aquarist, founder and co-owner of Hillstream Kingdom LLC, and expert on Hillstream loaches and other freshwater fishes from around Southeast Asia and the South Pacific. So, Sam, we finally are meeting to have this interview. I'm real excited.
Yeah.
Have some personal questions to ask, of course, first. So, how did you first become interested in fish and aquariums?
Oh, gosh. So, one of my earliest memories is being in Las Vegas, and my dad's holding me, and there's this giant saltwater aquarium. I found out that's what it was years later. But I remembered staring into this ocean, and it was, I guess, some aquarium in a casino lobby in Las Vegas. One of my earliest memories, that's how it programmed me. Later on, I started getting really interested in the pet store. As soon as I could talk, that would be like where I wanted to go. And so I instantly was drawn to having an aquarium as soon as my little memory can kick in. And my parents are like, you know, eventually. So, yeah.
You grew up in Maine, is that right?
Yeah. Rural Maine, mid-coast. So we grew up in Rockport. It's part of a five-town, like, traditional New England village. So we have a lot of lobstermen. That's part of our industry. And then we're really relying on tourism. So it's pretty dead for the whole year besides summer. And so summer, when the weather's perfect, that's when everyone comes to their summer houses and us townies kind of get stuck with the traffic.
Nice. So can you describe your very first tank, if you can remember it, how big it was, and maybe some fish you had?
Yeah. So it's actually a pretty good story. So we had this local pet shop called Holly Docks, and my grampy, who just recently passed away in early June, a day after his birthday, his 93rd
birthday. Sorry about that.
Ah, thanks. He had a good life, though. He had a lot of hobbies, and aquariums and garden ponds were one of them. And so another very first memory of mine is going to his house where him and my grammy retired to. It was just a little ranch. And they had dug out three little ponds that were connected by streams. And every year, even though it was illegal to do so in Maine, he would go and buy a couple goldfish at Holly Docks. And this is the early 90s. And so he'd put them into the ponds and be like, shush, don't tell anyone. And I thought it was the coolest thing. And so he would tell me stories about his fish tanks. And he had saved all of his tropical fish keeping books. So he had... I could go pull them out later, and they were gifted to me after he passed. but he has like some of the original tropical fish handles graded fish husbandry books, and I thought they were the coolest thing. I couldn't read them, but I'd sit there, flip through the pages, and I think that's the first time I saw like a real nice hobbyist fish tank fully planted, and it was like, I want that. Never gave it up. Seventh birthday, I come home, and we lived in this kind of little shoddy apartment, and sitting in the middle of our kind of dim living room was this glowing 40 tall. And my grampy had been keeping it at his house, and he had totally pimped it out. They had that crystal glass kind of paint that you could paint the back of aquariums, and it would kind of give you like a frozen ice pattern. He had done it with lime green. It had the plants with the little lead wrapping at the bottom for the weight. They were albino corys, cardinal tetras, and I think pork chop rasboras.
Wow, that's awesome. Great surprise.
Yeah, best gift I was ever given, I think.
Very cool, very cool. So fast forwarding a little bit, and we're going to talk obviously more about some of the specifics of some of these. Can you tell us about your current fish room? How many tanks and maybe what types of fish you have?
Yeah. So there are 16 10 gallons in my personal fish room. So I have two facilities, my personal fish room and then my wholesale facility. My personal in-home facility, I have 16 10 gallons, 6 20 talls, and 3 40 breeders. And then I have display tanks scattered around the house.
So you're hardcore.
Hardcore.
pretty much all fish from the areas we're going to talk about for the most part?
Yeah, only those areas. Only those areas.
Great. So I'm going to fast forward a little bit. You obviously went to college and then graduate school. Did your fish and aquarium keeping kind of follow you there? And or I guess, how did you choose what you ended up kind of studying and why as well?
Yeah. So I was always good at the hard sciences. So math, biology, chemistry just kind of came easy. So naturally, it seemed like I'd follow one of those degrees. So I initially chose biology, but then I fell into human biology. So a little more focused on vertebrates. And then for electives, you get to take sociology and psychology class. And so that's where I got my BA in. And sadly, I did not keep aquariums all the way through college, but I did have potted plants. And I got really into watching what people were doing in terms of aquascaping. So I felt like those years while I was learning my trade, essentially, or the first part of my trade, I was also learning what other people were doing in the hobby and kind of, you know, connecting all the gears and deciding what am I going to actually like assemble in my own fish room one day.
Okay. And I guess now going into what you had actually studied before we talk about your aquarium industry career, can you explain your other job as an epidemiologist and all the work you do? It sounds really interesting. And you did mention bats when you gave me some info.
Oh, yeah.
So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So in my undergraduate, when I was doing my BA in human bio, I did a study abroad at the only liberal arts university in Asia, which is Lingnan University. And what drew me to that was they were starting up a natural history department. And their natural history department was, and it did end up becoming, the best in Asia. And so when I went, I was taken under the wing of a professor named Lee Kenji, and he's kind of into biotech. He does stuff with the University of Hong Kong, and then I think also with Tsinghua. He was a visiting professor there, and he was helping with the Natural History Department. And my advisor back at Pitzer, so I went to the Claremont Colleges, which is an Oxford-style interdisciplinary model. So it's an assembly of 5 undergraduate colleges, and then a graduate university, and then a biotechnology school. And I think they're trying to add on the theology school there too, and the graduate school there, tons. So that's where I did my master's degrees and then my doctorate as well. But I did start out in bio. So jumping back to the bats though, my undergraduate advisor, Donald McFarland, has an interest in cave and tomb bats, specifically how they heat share during the day while they're taking refuge in their caves. So he sent me down there with the camera, and we took pictures of some of Myotis bats. So, Vesper bats, and then the pipistrelles of Guangxi. And then for my senior thesis, we came back and we actually analyzed the distribution of the individual cells of bats. And sure enough, they have their own roosting and heat sharing patterns, different across species and genre. And then for Lingnan, I was responsible for collecting fecal samples from all those bats. And so they carry like a lot of, let's say, rabies-like viruses, SARS-like viruses, and humans, they're very susceptible to them. And, you know, I don't know how many people they kill a year. That infections are something they're trying to remedy. And so, yeah, that was my little undergraduate job. Those were my research jobs. And then I fell into public health for grad school. I don't really have the stomach to be, I guess, like a true clinician that works with other organisms, like with my hands, like blood, death, just can't do it. So fish is kind of my tolerance. I can take fish dying, and anything past that, it kind of, you know, my mental health will gets a little messed up. So I do programming in public health now. So I do population programming, social intervention. So specifically gauged around towards mental health issues. Yeah. So it's kind of naturally matured into like a career of today, I guess.
So yeah, I'm assuming you wore like PPE during your bat collections and everything.
What's that?
You like gloves and, you know, and sort of.
Oh, like, yeah. There was a whole protocol. And so we would go with the professor and then other students that were also interested in the natural history program. And they would do their stuff too. So it was kind of like a whole ecosystem sampling. And this was kind of like the new Western approach because it was a liberal arts school. They just kind of wanted to list everything that was available in their biome at hand. And so we went on tons of nature walks. I don't know if we discussed me actually seeing hill stream loaches, but I did get to see Pseudogastrodon myersi in Hong Kong. And that was when my mind was blown. And I was like, oh my God, Asia is an alien world filled with alien organisms, and the West cannot even conceive of half of them.
Yeah, let's talk about fish. I have one quick question. Did you learn Cantonese or Mandarin? It was in English.
Poorly. So no, part of my curriculum was actually taking Cantonese and Mandarin lessons, and I think I got low Bs in them, and I also had to take English too.
Okay.
And so everyone in Hong Kong speaks perfect English with a British accent. And some of them are trying to get an American accent now. That was kind of after, like, you know, like their like social stuff happened with kind of rejoining the mainland. Kind of their rebellion was like, we're going to ditch the British accent for an American accent now.
That's funny.
Yeah. So no, pretty much everyone in China and I'd say Southeast Asia speaks English. Yeah, I love it. It's great. I think every American should visit there, spend at least a few weeks to a month.
Yeah, yeah. I got to spend some time in Hong Kong, do some work over there. That was cool. And in Singapore.
Where's your family from originally?
My family's actually originally from the Philippines. So,
oh wow,
which doesn't have hill stream loaches, unfortunately, but that's all right.
No, you have gobies though. You have gobies and lots of other stuff.
All right, so as we start our talk on the fish part now, I know, and I really appreciated your sending me that link to somewhat, you know, the talk you gave for Missouri, their aquarium society. I'd heard of the Wallace line and hadn't heard of any of the other lines, and definitely was not familiar with Sunda, Wallacea, or Sahul. Those are kind of really interesting features and sort of important, I think, for some of the things we're going to talk about. Can you give us a brief history in mini biogeography lessons to help put these fish in context?
Sure. So Southeast Asia, I like to think of it as like the true Atlantis. It's a sunken land. There are all these island nations that have unique fauna, and science was always completely perplexed by them. Where do we actually draw these faunal lines? And so over time, a lot of, say, like biologist geniuses have tried to deduce exactly what happened there. And it looks like there were three little mini continents, Sundaland, which would be mainland Asia, so Indochina connecting down to Vietnam, and then Borneo and Sumatra and peninsular Malaysia would also have been part of it. And then there was Wallacea, which was essentially like this pressure cooker of collision where the continental plates of Asia and Australia, the greater continents, collide, and they're pushing up this landmass together. It's kind of bubbling up. And it's this bizarre little, almost, I would say, like futuristic ecosystem of saltwater fauna, which have evolved to live in freshwater. So you have like these outrageously colored shrimp. And so it's its own little, we'll talk about it, but it's its own little ecosystem. And so that's Sulawesi is the island, the main island now. And then Timor, and then I think Missoul are part of it as well. And then Sahul. Sahul is Australia, Papua New Guinea. And they used to be connected. And so a lot of their fauna is shared. It's like Papua New Guinea is kind of like a tropical version of Australia. And Australia is like a more arid, plainsy version of Papua New Guinea. And so the scientists that have visited these areas have finally put together that about between 50,000 and 5,000 years ago, so pretty recently in terms of historical events, like modern anatomical humans, like me and you speak in modern languages, were walking around when the events I'm about to explain happened. There was a rapid seeking event. So no one knows exactly what happened, but it might have just been it was like a lowland kind of little freakish ecosystem that had persisted for a while, and finally tides caught up with it. But over the course of a few thousand years, and all these islands were split off from the mainland due to a mass sinking event. So Lord knows what lies underneath the ocean and the tectonic debris in the Indo-Pacific. I'm sure lots of humans, animals, and cultures lost. And it's recent. So pretty cool. I think there are a lot of doctorates to be gained in Asia from, say, human bio all the way to like their fauna. So yeah, really cool stuff happened there.
Yeah, definitely. And I appreciate that. It was pretty fascinating to kind of hear about it the first time when you heard you speak. So what first brought you into these areas, and how did you develop your passion for the interesting species within these areas?
I've been lucky enough to have traveled to Asia a few times in my life. And the first was when I was high school. I did a study abroad program for the summer in Myanmar, which at the time was called Burma, and Thailand. So I lived around the Chiang Mai area in northern Thailand. And I kind of got to see some Ballatoridae there. And I was like, oh, this kind of look like plecos, because they have like local fish shops where people bring in, you know, like their betas, their breeding. Beta breeding is pretty big in Thailand. And then when I was in Myanmar, I got to see like the fish export happen. So a lot of like truly like rare animals getting exported throughout what the town is that we stayed at, but it's just right over the border. It's like the tourist town in Myanmar. Back when you could go, I think it's no longer available for Western travel. And then we did stay at a rural village there, and I saw some like wild amphibians. So then fast forward, I went to study in Hong Kong, and I saw the true hill stream loaches, Gastromyzonidae, for the first time. Pseudogastromyzon myersi in Tai Mo Shan, which is the main mountain on Hong Kong's like mainland extension, which is called the New Territories. We went on a hike, and then this frigid, crystal clear stream. It must have been 90 degrees with like 125% humidity. So we were like drenched. And in Asia, a lot of the spring water is clean to drink when you get up pretty high elevations. So Professor Lee Kenji, who took us on the walk, was like, you know, you can drink this stuff. Every time I come here throughout the years, I fill up my bottle and drink it. So we went to the spring that Pseudogastromyzon myersi are like frolicking around in, and we fill our like water glasses. And it was the coolest thing to me. And I asked him like, what are those? Like, you know, like my little like Western eyes. I'm one of the only American exchange students for the year. Everyone else is like European or let's say Central Asian. So like you're like here's Kyrgyzstanis and Uzbekis that were there, and Russians too. And like they weren't interested in nature. Like they were just there to learn science. They wanted to learn how to do chemistry and biotech. And so essentially, Professor Lee Kenji was like, those are just sucker fish. Like, they're everywhere. They're like a zillion million species. Like, can't get rid of them. And I fell in love with them. And I was like, I'm going to have those at home one day. And so this is my junior year in college. And sure enough, I got to see more Gastromyzonidae. I got invited by a friend who was studying abroad in Taiwan to go to Borneo for 2 weeks. And we went on this nature walk. And I got to see true Gastromyzon in incredibly high density. They almost look like pest snails on rocks, again, in frigid, crystal clear streams, high elevation near the orangutan preserves. And I wish I knew what species they were, but again, they weren't a novelty to me because I'd already seen like Gastromyzonidae, like Pseudogastromyzon had already like stolen my heart in Hong Kong. So I was like more interested in the orangutans. So wish I would have investigated them, but I didn't.
That's funny. Yeah, it sounds like you had a lot of opportunities to kind of see them in different areas. We'll go forward a little bit. So can you tell us what made you found Hillstream Kingdom LLC and what your and your partner's goals are for that company?
Yeah. So the Hillstream loaches have always been like some sort of unattainable thing for me because no one was importing them. Occasionally, these fish will be imported under the name either Pseudogastromyzon, the Wellia, or Gastrumyzon wooey. And I'm using air quotes here for people that can't see me. And wooey, this is their Latin name. It's not a scientific name. It just means all mixed together in Asia. And so prior to like me, it was truly me and my team dissecting all of their species and assigning pictures to them based on catch locations. We're coming in mixed. No one could get permanent colonies of them. Wet Spot did a pretty good job of like splitting out contaminants from like their Sewellia lineolata offerings that they get through. I think it's one of like Hanoi Aquarium or whatever it is, the exporter out of Vietnam. And then Pseudogastrumyzon would come in infrequently whenever Hong Kong would be available for Western export when it wasn't like having restrictions put on it. And or the occasional Westerner would go over to China to make an actual partnership, because the Chinese are very family oriented and they're not very prone to doing business with anyone other than their family members overseas. So my partners are kind of like a blessing. They're younger than me, mid-20s. My friend, well, he's truly like my, they're my friends also. We call each other brothers. That's kind of like the title I've earned with them through doing business, is they trust me like a family member. Jason Wang, he kind of wants to be like the David Attenborough of China. So he's making a lot of really cool homemade documentaries now. And prior to doing that, he did cameraman work for like the Chinese version of BBC. Doing like local nature documentaries. So he got to play with like macro lenses. So he does all of our photography. He also knows the import export game. And we each kind of like made a 50-50 investment into our import export house. So eventually they want me to export our native North American darters, which are fabulous unheated aquarium fish. And people don't know a thing about them. So the Ethiostoma genus and the Persina genus, they're captive breeding, just plain old rainbow darters and green darters and banded darters in China. And they fetch like 800 Chinese yuan, which is like $120. And here Jonah's Aquarium sells them for like $8. And so no one knows about them, but they're that beautiful. It's like, that's what they're truly worth. And so the Hillstream loaches, I wanted them here. I think that they're worth having aquariums, fish rooms like mine. So my entire fish room, the only bottom dwellers I have are Hillstream loaches and let's say pest invertebrates like black worms, white worms, and microworms. And those kind of like, they'll feed off of those and those feed to fry.
Okay, great. Well, let us take a break and we'll take a short break and continue our discussion with my guest, Sam Fernald of Hillstream Kingdom LLC after a word from our sponsors.
Begging to hear more of your favorite show? Full episodes of all our shows are available on demand. Go to PetLifeRadio.com to fetch our entire lineup of Possum Pet Podcasts. Also, dig us up in iHeartRadio and iTunes. Let's talk pets. Live and on demand, only from Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
And we're back and continuing our discussion of Hillstream loaches with my guest, Sam Fernald of Hillstream Kingdom LLC. All right, Sam, with that intro and kind of getting to know you a little bit better and how all of this came to be, let's dive into the Hillstream loaches more specifically. I guess let's start with talking about what kind of habitats these fish usually inhabit. Can you explain that to them, our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So Hillstream loaches are amazing, and they are endemic to Sundaland. And so we already went over the biogeography. So Sundaland ranges from like truly tropical equatorial environments like Borneo. The equator literally runs right through it. And you get Hillstream loaches that come from a little bit more tropical, warmer summer. So the Borneo loaches can take it quite warm. They'll come from little streams, but I kind of call them more like jungle creeks. So you'll see like more of like a jungle gravelly substrate with them and more of smoothed out rock ledges like you see in South America, more of like a reddish substrate to those streams. And so the Gastrumyzon and Neogastrumyzon, which are also from there, and Hypergastrumyzon, those are jungle creek fish. They're really flexible in temperature. They can go down to the low 60s all the way up to the high 80s with proper water turnover because those hill streams never stop moving. And then the Hillstream loaches can also be found in what I would call true hill streams, which are more temperate, come from temperate rainforests, like a little bit, a few degrees up in latitude. So like in northern Vietnam, you'll find Sawelia and cloud forests, which are these almost like southern South America, very misty mountains, orchids, really heavy like beard mosses, and giant boulders now rather than jungle creeks. So really big granite boulders, which are kind of the leftover from the continent getting battered with rising tides and sinking and rising. And then more temperate rivers. So in China, some of the hill stream loaches will actually be able to tolerate down into the mid-40s. And these would be ideal pond and, let's say, outdoor hill stream fish for us in the southern United States. I think they'd make fabulous additions to garden ponds. Great ornamental fish, slow to reproduce. So a pair will maybe give you 20 babies every 3 months, so they couldn't be invasive. They like to be in the sun, so they're always out and about.
Why don't you, since you've kind of mentioned a couple of the different groups, and can you maybe for the listeners sort of describe kind of what they look like and, yeah, a little bit of the differences maybe between the two major families and then the family I know you kind of like a little more.
Yeah. So broadly, hill stream loaches, they're what I call true hill stream loaches, which are Gastromyzonidae, and then lizard or whiptail hill stream loaches, which are Ballatoridae. And these are nocturnal Ballatoridae, or heavily scaled, nocturnal, almost micropredators that live in riffles, more in headwaters. So they're very oxygen dependent, and they're more a little primitive. They seem like a little more like ancestor fish or like earlier genre than what I'm interested in, which are Gastromyzonidae or true hill stream loaches. And true hill stream loaches come from a bunch of different families. And again, they're from a few land masses. And you can tell them apart based on which landmass they come from. So the Borneo hill stream loaches have these outrageous tropical patterns like you would see on rainbow fish almost. So iridophores, which are light capturing reflective cells, which give them more of a radiant light rather than true pigment. So they sparkle under high light, which is what they like. So if you ever see these fish in the wild, they're in the sun in these like crystal clear jungle creeks, and they sparkle like living diamonds almost. And they graze like cattle, and they talk to each other, which is amazing. All families are able to click jaws and rasp on diminished swim bladders. So although it's inaudible to us, fish are able to make their own sounds. And so moving up to the more commonly known loaches from Gastrumyzonidae would be like your reticulated hill stream loaches. And the other Sawelia, like Sawelia SP spotted, which has now been described as Sawelia hypsicrotea. And those are more like they call them UFO shaped or stingray shaped hill stream loaches. And then as you go more northward, you'll find that those UFO shaped hill stream loaches begin to bleed into what I call dragon hill stream loaches, which are more colorful, say like almost salamander looking hill stream loaches. And those can be split into a few lineages. The Chinese ones are my favorite, specifically the sailfin hill stream loaches, and those are Pseudogastromyzon and Labiogastromyzon. Their common names would be the purple fin hill stream loach would be one that most people would know, Pseudogastromyzon laticeps. One of the goals of our import house is to bring every species and every location of it and establish it in the United States in either a home aquarium, a garden center, a nature preserve, or a home pond, what have you. I think they're that special that they need to be protected. And I worry for them as Asia develops that they could be lost.
And I think one of the things you had kind of mentioned before, their kind of anatomy is a little interesting relative to some of the other species. Can you maybe talk about their anatomy and their finnage differences?
Yeah. So the hill stream loaches, rather than like your traditional suckerfish, which just have its mouth part adapted to being a suction plate, hill stream loaches entire underside. So it's like from their mouth all the way down to their urogenital region is their suction plate. And they're able to articulate every fin ray in their pectoral and pelvic fin. So thinking of them as like arms and legs, they can articulate them like fingers, essentially. And another thing about them is they have these calcified nodules, 4 to 7, on each pectoral and pelvic fin, almost like the formation of, like, I don't know, you're a veterinarian, maybe you could tell me this, if cartilage is a precursor to bone material forming in evolution.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's almost like they're developing new bone structures within their fins. And the higher in elevation you go, you then get to see the suction plate get lost. And the fish almost begin to gain like a newt morphology and like Van Manenia, which I call shark suckers. And they actually stand up and like sculpins will walk on all four limbs. And one can't help but tie in this ecosystem of going higher and higher up in elevation as a decrease in H2O and an increase of air. And the fish are kind of adapting to it. So I've always been perplexed by this conundrum as, okay, the fish are adapting to moving in like almost like a freshwater tide pool, which is tide going up and down in these ever-changing kill streams through wet and dry season. So they've adapted this complete underside suction plate to crawl up rocks. They're tough as nails, essentially. So counterintuitively, they can last for like a week or two and then a large enough body of water without water movement because they're loaches. Loaches are pretty tough. And then they'll kind of like wait until the rain hits again and then they'll move back to a stream. And then they actually fry sometimes in these like stagnant water bodies, which are like pools. And so these are very mobile fish. And then as you get higher, they get to more like these steady mountain springs where it's like the water level's only a few centimeters, this bizarre newt morphology begins to emerge. And then you find them cohabitating with like true newts, like the blue-tailed Cynops, fire-bellied newts in Asia. So you'll find as you go high, high up in elevation that you arrive to a point where what I call like the shark suckers that are like salamander, they almost look like salamander hills true newt, loaches meet true newts. And one thinks like, oh my God, is this it? Is this the missing link? Is this the jump between water vertebrates and land vertebrates? And it's just been here the whole time and we just haven't made the jump. And so here in America, we actually have some crevice-dwelling salamanders that only exist in headwaters, like the green salamander from the Plethodontae groupings. And they are dependent on trickles of spring water keeping their eggs wet. And they're lungless. All of our salamanders here are lungless salamanders. I just think it's the coolest thing. I think all these dots need to be connected. And someone's so close. Yeah. I hope they come soon.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah, that is interesting, whether it's convergent or whether it's actually like relate, you know. Yeah, that's
cool. Yeah.
So let's talk about aquariums and tank setups now. My first question for you is, are these a good beginner fish or are they going to be more for advanced hobbyists?
Oh, no, they're perfect for beginners. So they're actually pretty economical too. They don't require a heater. All they require is, let's say, a Hardy bubble. So they can't lose oxygen for more than, let's say, 36 hours because that's the time window I give them for being a perishable good in transit. And so in the home aquarium in high density, it's about that too. So in a planted, well-dense aquarium, all they require is an air pump. They like a natural fluctuation in temperature throughout the day, like say like a salamander or your amphibians that are about room temperature that you keep in a terrarium. You don't require heat. They do require bright light though. And so I do suggest keeping like a grow light on their aquarium to get a nice biofilm to grow. And so they're grazing fish. So it's not that they're not beginner friendly, it's people jump the gun on getting them and they have immature aquariums. And the most critical part is that you have what I call is like a general substrate layer that they can accept as being the utilized substrate for their reproduction and general foraging. They will, like plecos and coriodoras, filter sand through their little gill plates and pick out edible particles in addition to grazing. And so that substrate layer needs to mature with microfauna, so copepods, and then ideally like microworms, detritus worms, what have you. And the bright light creates algae. And the algae plus these microfauna give us something called offflux, which is its own little micro universe. And it's like a living algae wafer, essentially.
Kind of like a lot of the African cichlids, right?
Yeah, yeah. The raspers from the Tanganyikan cichlids will rasp on hair algae that's also bonded to endemic microfauna and get their full nutritional profile that way. So the Holstein loaches have these itty bitty little mouths because they're always sorting through these bits of natural algae wafers, offflux, let's just call it slime coat. And then they'll filter pieces of sand and kind of pop the little grains of sand out through their gills. And then you're like, oh, I found a worm. And so what people miss is that you really need to let your aquarium mature. So it's almost like an aquatic terrarium we're making for them. We're going to have a sandy, gravelly substrate. I really like to use smooth ocean stones rather than, let's say, like traditional aquarium substrate or traditional hardscape you can buy. I find the smoother the surface, the happier they are. And the more consistent the algae profile is. So I use a combination of unglazed terracotta pots for them to hang on to, which is also great for anaerobic bacteria to colonize inside of. Almost functions like a giant ceramic ring. And I fill it up with, again, I fill it up with that sandy gravelly substrate, maybe lay a few smooth little pebbles on top because the loaches for enrichment, they just love digging around in it. And as soon as your tank matures and you're ready for them and you dump them in, you just get this show. And yeah, I think that they're perfectly beginner friendly. It's just people jump the gun on getting them. They see them, they want them. They're the coolest, newest thing right now on the hobby, which sadly kind of leads to a lot of death in this industry, is people just don't know. So if we can dispel them here together today, I think that, you know, we're onto something cool.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. So I guess just to kind of clarify, and, you know, obviously Maine kind of room temp versus like Florida room temp, although obviously we have AC down here.
Yeah.
Like when you say temperatures, I guess you said some can take it really cold, but in general, a lot of them can handle 60 to 80-ish. I mean, obviously not that huge flux in one time, but.
We'll see. So I would say like the hard boundary would be 60 for the minimum, 85 for the maximum.
Okay.
So all genre will be able to exist in that. So like kind of like your bedroom temperature, no one's going to sleep in a 90-degree bedroom, you know? So like, that's kind of what I call them, is like a bedroom display. I used to have this long 20-gallon in here, and it had Pseudogastrocnemius fasciatus and Veggie Yang, which are my absolute favorite species and location of Hillstream loach. And sadly, you know, they weren't mine because they were the businesses and they were for sale, and they got sold off. They got sold, and so they had to go, and then the tank went because I'm the pest nail. I don't look at a tank full of pest nails. So, you know, they got sold off, but yeah, they're bedroom fish essentially, or an unheated fish room. So some people like to, like, you know, have like a fish room that they keep like always like high 70s, high 80s. If they keep discus or plecos to keep them breeding, not like that. Hillstream loaches are going to be their own thing. It's going to be an unheated fish room. But along with that come a whole new profile of fish that absolutely love that temperature range as well. And we can discuss those if you want to, either now or later.
Yeah, actually, a couple of more quick things with regard to water quality. I think I'm assuming, you know, same deal. You don't want any ammonia or nitrite. And,
no.
And I think you had mentioned something about common water changes often. Is that right?
Yeah. So actually, there are some quirks to this species. It's kind of like a new habit that you're going to have to get into. If you want to be a hill, they're starting to call themselves hilly hobbyists. H-I-L-L-I or H-I-L-L-I-E is what they're calling themselves on Facebook now. And these are people that are just kind of like generally finding out the best practices for these, even though like I've given them my best information. It seems like people are kind of always innovating in the hobby. And so for water changes, it does look like if you want to get them to always be in production, they're receptive to having a cool water change every once in a while to activate their breeding. So again, if you are kind of lazy on water changes, you want to have them in a more densely planted aquarium. When you're doing your water changes, this is something that's very critical about a breeding colony, which I need to say here. The loaches utilize their substrate as where they lay their eggs. Some will use elongated tails, like the mainland China genuses, which I really love. The Sailfin Hillstream loaches will use their long tail to clear out a burrow where they'll adhere some eggs to the bottom surface of the rock and then brush it shut. Or some will literally, they'll do a mating dance in the water column in a mass event, will release their eggs and milk, or they will just be egg scatterers. They will brush up against a rock surface or plant, or again, just in a little ditch in the substrate and deposit eggs and milk. So you cannot vacuum your substrate with these fish at all. You cannot. You will lose fry out the window if you do. So although it seems kind of counterintuitive, you have to have like mulm piles building up in the corner. And the babies are dependent on eating their parent species to get their bacteria profile to digest a lot of, let's say, heavy plant matter that they encounter as grazers. And so this is actually something across most grazing animals. You'll see that animals that have high cellulose intake require specialized bacteria from their parents. So in overly clean tanks, people are learning that the babies just kind of wilt. They diminish into these little, like, sickly thin things, and then they die. And then tanks that are constantly pumped through with antibiotics actually also have this effect on the fry too. So you kind of want to quarantine them. Diseases, you'll just want to do parasite treatment with them. And then for a broad spectrum antibiotic, if I see them like with a lesion that I'm worried about getting infected due to sharp substrate, I use doxycycline. I think that's just a good broad spectrum topical internal, external. You'd also use like the nitro purezone kanamycin combo, et cetera. But don't like be constantly pumping antibiotics through these fish. Like after you get them clean, get them into a well-planted, gravelly substrated, sandy aquarium with smooth stones, and then stay up on cool water changes, I'd say daily for the gastromyzon for 3 days if you want to get them to breed. And then for all other genera, it would just be bi-monthly or weekly if you're feeding heavily based on how heavy you feed them. Okay. Pretty friendly in terms of husbandry. It's just, you know, like I do like 5 Fahrenheit degree cooler with the gastromyzon to trick them into thinking it rained. And actually tap water, it being a different pH, will also trick them into being like, oh, it's rainy season, for the more tropical equatorial species. The more northern species like Sewellia, mainland China genuses, will breed uninterrupted as soon as they're comfy and or given like a cool water change to jumpstart them.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
I guess one more quick question and then we're going to have to wrap it up, but I'll definitely have you on again and we'll talk about some of the other species that can go with them. But I guess in terms of like numbers and, you know, social/aggression, like what are your thoughts on that for people that want to get these?
Okay. So these are amazing. You can have, what I like to do is I pick a colorful species from each genre. So I pick, let me talk about stocking first before I jump the gun and I get people all excited about going out and buying these. Stocking, the more the merrier, but with the more you have, the more you have to stay up on the husbandry of the aquarium or have it be automated plumbed, which is something people are starting to try to do with their fish rooms, which is what mine is. So I kind of feed heavy and, you know, I have dense stocking. So in a 20 long, I would say you could have 60 loaches from 20 from 3 separate genres. So you could have 20 Sewellia from one species. So 20, I would pick 20 for a beginner. I'd do 20 Sewellia lineolata in a 20 long first, let it mature. Then I would add 20 Borneo suckers. And then I would add 20 pseudogastromyzon, probably the Myers Hillstream loach or Cheney. And these would be good intro Hillstream loaches for people. And you can see how they all interact. And you'll see that they are incredibly social. And their aggression level is minimal. They have these little downward facing mouths so they can't nip anyone to death like your stone loaches do. I do love Botias. I do love your Shistura loaches, but they are not community fish. They will suck down anything that has shiny eyes. They'll inhale it out of their little skulls or invertebrates or quick lunch. The Hillstream loaches are invert friendly and their little jaws are so weak they can't pop other fish's eggs or their own. So they're fry and egg safe. And you'll see that they enter into this bizarre little talk with each other in the most bright, let's say, flat surface in your aquarium, whether it's a plane of glass, a flat rock in a place of flow that gets especially bright light, or the inside of a flower pot sitting upright. They really like that. And they all kind of congregate every once in a while and they enter into these like dominance displays and then they disperse back to their own little sub territories. So they're very social fish and they require the company of others. And it doesn't have to be from their own species. It can be from another genre. So you'll see people kind of keep like little specimen-y type aquariums, which I don't like. I think that they're so important to have breeding here because they're so delicate for international export. Like they have that 36-hour perishable good window. So if your system or they're in a bag for 36 hours, anything past that, you're going to run into health issues. Like they begin to die. Get high okay. DOA. So if they make it here, it's important to establish them. So I think they're critical to getting on a lot of the Florida farms and Texas farms, in addition to like some of the rainbow fish and rice fish we'll talk about in another episode. But yeah.
No, that sounds good. Yeah.
Colorful community fish.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk more in another interview, but unfortunately we are out of time. I did want to thank you, Sam, and our producer, Mark Winter, for making this show possible. Sam, do you have any real quick words of wisdom, final thoughts? And we'll get more of your thoughts in another interview.
I would just say keep those aquariums mature before you get the fish. Buy them from a reputable breeder. So rather than spend $12 for a sickly Borneo sucker at your local fish store that just popped in, I'd look for a breeder or a reputable importer like me. Marcel's Fish is also really good. He breeds a lot of really great Sewellia. There's a band called Rose Line 17's Hillstream Loaches where you can buy some of their rare Sewellia if you get into those. And I think he's starting to breed some of the fish I sell him. So okay. I deworm, I clean all my fish. So I'm also a reputable place. I'd also recommend Dan's Fish and Wet Spot. And then if Imperial Tropicals ever has them in, they're also good too. So
okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
HillstreamKingdom.com, and I have a new shipment coming in at the beginning of August, and there will be some very colorful, pretty rare China fish in that. So I'm gonna have those awesome Zhejiang fish back.
Well, thanks. Please be sure to check out Sam's web links we'll have on his Aquarium Mania episode guest page. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, email me at drroy@petliferadio.com. That's DRROY at petliferadio.com. Until next time, please visit your local aquarium stores and keep your tanks clean and your fish healthy. And definitely check out the beautiful Hillstream Loaches and other cool fish available at Hillstream Kingdom LLC.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.